Publication is, I think, very important to a writer. If I hadn't succeeded in publishing Junkie, I might just have given up writing.
What do you think the fact or the state of that represents? Is it just an end of something, or is it a transition, or like when you mentioned books like the Tibetan Book of the Dead and all that, do they indicate that there is more than we normally realize?
There are all kinds of attitudes.
No, I mean in our culture.
Towards death. Well, as I said, Kim had never doubted the existence of the possibility of afterlife. Mm-hmm. And Kim is my alter ego, spokesman, my where
he
exists. He's the White House spokesman.
Who's that?
But now, however, the Egyptian and the Tibetan book, they're quite different, because the Tibetan book was based on the premises of reincarnation, whereas the Egyptians had no concept of reincarnation.
But they believed in death after or resurrection, because they kept their mummies.
Only those mummies that resurrected. That's what Egyptians took the body like a vulture takes.
It's a creative effect.
The body.
That's me. So
I know, it's a creative effect that you're doing.
I know, it's because useful some shit.
Well, very unsatisfactory, put it mildly.
Well, and your personal feeling about that is the reincarnation?
Humbles, eh? I'm going to take that. That's for granted. Possibility of the incarnation. And of course, I agree with the Buddhist system that it's something to be avoided if possible. Mm-hmm. It's the worst thing that can happen. The mea delito del hombre es haber nacido.
What's that in English?
That means the worst mistake. Say is to have been born in the first place.
That's a good sample.
But I am going to switch to this.
Here I am, my alter ego has never doubted the existence of God.
By the way, I am recording this in some form.
Oh, how?
Room audio.
Oh, okay. The room audio.
You can also blend the levels of the movie with the second knob.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's 2006.
Kind of war, at least a shadowy enemy that can never be defeated. either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Generation after generation will have to lay down its liberty in an endless war for the global empire.
It was a breathtaking display of firepower.
And the Pentagon said,
populations to relinquish their liberty in the name of security.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
And if he does not disarm, the United States of America will lead a coalition and disarm him in the name of peace.
We've been told that we're facing a 100-year war. Will last generation after generation. In this film, we will explore who pulls the strings and who benefits from the dark spectacle of modern warfare. We will answer the question, do the people know how they are controlled? Do they understand the systems of power that surround them, the modern propaganda machines of public relations that wash their brains and fill their minds full of ball games and mindless fluff? Is the population beginning to realize that governments throughout history have used the specter of fear to drive their populations into acquiescing to total tyranny? September 11th, National ID Drives, Big Brother, the Iraq War, the 7/7 bombings in London, the invasion of Iran, how are they all interconnected? In previous films, we have focused predominantly on September 11th as the foundational event, the pretext for the current geopolitical structure.
The smartest thing to do is pull it. They made that decision to pull, and we watched the building collapse.
National polls show that most Americans and Westerners believe the official story of 9/11 to be a fraud, and a large part of that majority believes that 9/11 was an inside job. But the establishment press continues to contest any alternative view concerning 9/11. In this documentary, we will first look at historical events that are not contested, events where the fact of government-sponsored terror is not debated, but in fact openly admitted to by Western governments. There are literally hundreds of examples of government-sponsored terrorism in modern history, over there known as false flag operations. We're going to start by looking at just five past examples, then we'll look at several modern cases. What is a false flag? The encyclopedia definition reads, false flag operations are covert operations conducted by government corporations or by other organizations which are designed to appear as if they were carried out by other groups. The name is derived from the military concept of flying false flags, that is, flying the flag of a country other than your own. There are many variants of false flag operations, but one of the most popular carried out by government is to stage a terror attack or horrible criminal incident and then blame it on your political enemies. One of the best known cases of a false flag op was carried out by the newly elected Adolf Hitler on February 27, 1933. Nazi documents uncovered at the end of World War II, as well as testimony during the Nuremberg trials, revealed what many historians already suspected, that Hermann Göring had set fire to the Reichstag, the German Parliament building. The Nazis then produced their patsy, Marinus van der Lubbe, an extremely mentally handicapped young man who was found rolling around in an alley behind the Reichstag, naked. Van der Lubbe was then taken before a Nazi show trial, found guilty, and sentenced to death. He was beheaded on January 10, 1934. Using the crisis he had created, passed laws similar to the USA Patriot Act, Hitler became dictator and set his sights on the world. By March of 1939, Hitler had already seized Czechoslovakia. Having gained both Austria and Czechoslovakia, Hitler desired to move east against Poland. But he did not want to look like the aggressor. Hitler needed an excuse for attacking Poland. It was Heinrich Himmler who came up with a plan. Thus, the operation was codenamed Operation Himmler. 9 o'clock, 1939, the Germans took an unknown prisoner from one of the concentration camps, dressed him in a Polish uniform, took him to the town of Gliwice on the German-Polish border, and then shot him. The stage scene of the dead prisoner, dressed in a Polish uniform, was supposed to appear as a Polish attack against the German radio station. German radio newspapers and news reels were flooded with images of what appeared to be a dead Polish soldier who had dared attack the Reich. Now Hitler had his excuse to invade Poland, and the nightmare of World War II had begun. Central Intelligence Agency, working in tandem with MI6, overthrew the democratically elected leader of Iran, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh had been educated in the West, was pro-America, and had driven communist forces out of the north of his country shortly after being elected in 1951. Mossadegh then nationalized the oil fields and denied British Petroleum a monopoly. CIA's own history department at CIA.gov details how U.S. and British intelligence agents carried out terror attacks and then subsequently blamed them on Mossadegh. In the late 1990s, large sections of Operation Ajax were declassified. The field commander of Operation Ajax was none other than the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, Kermit Roosevelt. Before his death in 2000, Roosevelt went public to the media, bragging about his patriotism and carrying out terror attacks in Iran and blaming it on the government. The provocations included propaganda, demonstrations, bribery, agents of influence, and false flag operations. They bombed the home of a prominent religious leader and blamed it on Mossadegh. They attacked mosques, machine gun crowns, and then handed out thousands of handbills claiming that Mossadegh had done it. The handbills read, "Up with Mossadegh, up with communism, down with Allah." Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh was incarcerated for the duration of his life. He fared better than many of his ministers, who were executed just days after the successful coup for crimes that MI6 and CIA had committed. The CIA then formed a dreaded Iranian secret
police,
and a 25-year reign of terror and torture then commenced. The operation was seen by Western intelligence agencies as a huge success. The CIA then successfully used the exact same technique in scores of countries to overthrow elected governments and dictators alike. Is an umbrella name for literally hundreds of bombings carried out by Western intelligence agencies and NATO in Italy, Western Europe, the Middle East, Latin America, and Asia. From 1947 until 1981, Italian presidents have gone public admitting Operation Gladio targeted innocent civilians and was to be blamed on leftists and communists. On November 22, 1990, the European Parliament had a resolution condemning the activities of Operation Gladio. The former Italian intelligence chief has come clean concerning Gladio's actions as well. Many other countries have declassified documents concerning Gladio. It is part of the public record that our government and other Western governments targeted trains, buses, schools. Several times operatives zeroed in on school buses, knowing that images of dead children would get the population hopping mad and ready to relinquish their liberties. A particularly bloody bombing at the central station of Bologna, Italy, on the morning of August 2nd, 1980, which killed 85 people and wounded more than 200 some Italian officials to break their silence and begin to expose just a small part of this wicked operation. And now the Gulf of Tonkin incident. In the summer of 1954, President Lyndon Baines Johnson needed a pretext to commit the American people to the already expanding covert war in Southeast Asia.
Great communism. PT boat attacked an American destroyer off the coast of Vietnam yesterday. And today, President Johnson's response was hard and tough.
To any armed attack upon our forces, we shall reply. To any in Southeast Asia who ask our help in defending their freedom, we shall give it.
In November of 2001, the LBJ Presidential Library and Museum released tapes of phone conversations with the President and then Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, where they openly discussed plans to use the staged Gulf of Tonkin incident as a pretext to expand the war. Then, in late 2005, the National Security Agency declassified its own official history of the Gulf of Tonkin and admitted that intelligence agency officers deliberately skewed the intelligence and claimed that Vietnamese patrol boats that attacked U.S. destroyers on August 4th, 1964, when in reality
left
they
side.
Had done nothing, even
left
while
side.
Being fired
on
by U.S.
Left side. Up.
Congress then authorized
left side up.
The Tonkin resolution
of the keyboard. It's the top left side. See the top left button?
This one?
No, the red light.
This one?
Yeah, find Arabic.
I didn't realize
on
you could
October
do that.
1976,
whole
there's so
time
much
bombs,
more. Native C-4 planned on a Douglas DC-8 aircraft exploded, killing all 73 people on board in the most deadly act of airline terrorism in the Western Hemisphere until September 11, 2001. The plane was carrying Olympic athletes from three countries, including gold medal winners from Cuba. Declassified FBI and CIA documents show that the convicted bombers of the flight had been given U.S. visas just days before the attack, and that they were in the employ of the U.S. government. This had been reported on in respective publications for years, but has now been confirmed by multiple declassifications. Cuban plane bomber was CIA agent. Declassified U.S. government documents show that a man suspected of involvement in the bombing of a Cuban passenger plane worked for the CIA. Luis Posada Carrillo. Flag operations as a pretext to invade Cuba and for war with the Soviet Union. In Operation Northwoods, they planned to hijack jets by remote control, crash them, and blame the attack on Cuba. There were many other terrorist attacks they planned to carry out that were contained within the document. One scenario mentioned was the destruction of a U.S. naval vessel that was to be blamed on a foreign power as a pretext for war with any enemy they picked. President Lyndon Baines Johnson went operational with Northwoods on June 8, 1967 during the Six-Day War. During the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arab nations, the USS Liberty was sent by Johnson to collect electronic intelligence in the Eastern Mediterranean. The clearly marked U.S. intelligence ship was 14 miles off the coast of Israel in international waters.
You know the USS Liberty, of course, right? You know the USS Liberty.
Oh yeah, I know all that.
This film came out in 2006.
Geez, senior chairman.
Israeli surveillance aircraft flew low over the ship and clearly identified it as an American vessel. At 2 p.m. that afternoon, the USS Liberty was attacked by three Mirage 3 fighter bombers. From the onset of the attack, the fighter bombers were jamming U.S. signals. Not only were they jamming U.S. signals specifically, they were also unmarked, the only unmarked aircraft in Israel's arsenal. The fighter bombers strafed the ships with their cannons, dropped conventional munitions and napalm on the ship, repeatedly from stem to stern. After the Mirages had done their work, the ship was hit by medium bomber Dassault missiles carrying napalm and other munitions like white phosphorus. The USS Liberty was then attacked by three Israeli torpedo boats bearing Israeli flags. The torpedo gunboats opened fire with high-caliber machine guns and launched torpedoes. A single torpedo struck the ship, blowing a hole in both sides, entering the ship and leaving a 30-foot exit hole when it exploded. torpedo boats began strafing lifecrafts in the water on international water. While all of this was happening, an oversized American flag flew clear above the ship. The attack on the Liberty went on for hour after hour after hour. During the entire attack, USS Liberty continually called the Sixth Fleet that was nearby, begging for air rescue. Two aircraft carriers and the men responded by launching fighter aircraft. Unbelievably, they were recalled by the White House. Rear Admiral Geisen, commanding the carriers in the Sixth Fleet, called Washington personally to confirm the recall order. Secretary of Defense McNamara came on the line, and then President Johnson himself told Geist, "I want that docket." He called the wings. Imagine being Admiral Geist begging the President to allow you to defend an American ship that's under attack, and being told by him that he wants the ship going to the bottom. Despite the fact that the U.S. carriers withdrew their help, a Russian spy ship appeared and witnessed part of the attack. After 3 hours into the attack, the Israelis withdrew because there were witnesses, allowing the damaged USS Liberty a limp to safety. 40 years after the attack on the USS Liberty, we know exactly what happened. I've interviewed former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Thomas Moore. I've interviewed the admirals that were on the line, who heard what President Johnson said. I've even talked to the head JAG officer of the Navy, who was ordered to falsify the reports. Cover up what really happened. One of the Israeli pilots is on public as well, saying that 3 times he refused over his radio to headquarters to attack the ship, saying clearly that it was an American ship in international waters, and now he was ordered under threat of court-martial to engage the ship. In a nutshell, this is what happened. President Johnson had personal control of the ship, parked it in the Mediterranean, made a backroom deal with Israel to attack it with an order to kill all aboard. Then the attack on the ship would be blamed on Egypt. The U.S. would enter the war and take over the entire Middle East. In the aftermath of the attack, the most highly decorated ship in U.S. history, the captain and his entire crew were told they would spend life in prison or be killed if they told anyone what happened. Captain William L. McGonagall was given the Congressional Medal of Honor in secret and told not to tell anyone that he had won the war.
Links to Spanish security services, including the head of their bombs.
I wish we had the digital key controllers. I'm getting it tomorrow.
The exact same earmarks, the same MO in the London bombs.
And we'd be able to control the pitch of Alex Jones' voice.
On the morning of July 7th, 2005, three trains and a city bus were ripped to pieces when four military-grade explosive devices detonated. At 8:50 a.m., three explosive devices simultaneously detonated on three separate trains. Within minutes, eyewitnesses were reporting to the press that there had been multiple terror attacks, despite the fact that three train cars were burning wrecks strewn with dead and dying Londoners. Scotland Yard, for over an hour and a half, claimed that all of the disruptions were simply caused by a power outage in the London Underground.
That was certainly on the underground. That's what we heard. I mean, the bus was about an hour off the underground, so that's when I think everybody knew that it wasn't what it was, you know. It was just an excuse, power surge, whatever.
Why would they say that? I don't know what it was.
Trying to cover up, probably, you know what I mean? So there was no panic and everybody sort of like just get on with everything, you know, so.
Then mysteriously, 50 minutes into the attack, the London Police Department orders the number 30 Hackney to Marble Arch bus to leave its normal route and depart at the corner of Woburn Square and Tavistock Place. At 9:47, a fourth bomb detonates, killing 13 civilians and injuring many others. Note, out of several hundred buses in service that morning, it's the only bus that the police take special control of and direct to Tavistock Square.
I've been walking up and down this road all the for a number 30. The bus stops have all the numbers of the buses on them individually. There's no number 30 on any of the bus stops. That's because the number 30 bus was specifically rerouted here on that day.
To simplify, there's no bus stop.
There's no number 30 bus stop here, no.
Well, that was in the news, and it was specifically diverted here.
They admitted that the number 30 bus was the only bus that was directed to a different area of the city. For what reason? Nobody knows, but they admit that. So it's very strange that for no reason it would come down this road when it's wrong.
Remember, while all this is happening, the police are on radio and TV telling everyone that it's just a power failure, an outage. Meanwhile, commuters on the bus were listening to other radio reports where eyewitnesses were reporting explosions. The supposed bomber on the bus with a rucksack became panicked and began looking in his rucksack in what witnesses said was a confused and frightened manner. Weeks later, police detectives investigating the case said that all four of the bombers on the three trains and the bus didn't fit the MO, the modus operandi, of bombers. They bought two-way tickets. They'd played games of cricket the night before. They had good jobs and happy families. One of the alleged bombers was caught by surveillance camera arguing with the ticket clerk about the price of his pass. After Scotland Yard detectives had a chance to talk to some of the eyewitnesses from the bus and the trains, they stated clearly on the record that they believed that the bombers did not know that they had explosives in their backpacks. This was only one of many huge developments in the case that only received bare mentions in the back of the newspaper. The July 29th edition of Fox News Channel's Dayside program revealed that the so-called mastermind of the 7/7 bombings, Harun Rashid Aswan, is a British intelligence asset. Former Justice Department prosecutor and FBI terror expert John Loftus exposed the fact that Aswan was being protected by MI6 and was clearly under their control.
Aswan is believed to be the mastermind of all the bombings in London.
From on the 7/7 and 7/21, this is the guy, we think.
This is the guy, and what's really embarrassing is that the entire British police are chasing him, and one wing of the British government, MI6, or the British Secret Service, has been hiding him. And this has been a real source of contention between CIA and Justice Department in Britain. MI6 has been hiding him. Are you saying that he has been working for them? Oh, I'm not saying it. This is what the Muslim Sheikh said in an interview in a British newspaper back in 2001.
So he's a double agent.
Oh, one's a double agent.
He's working for the Brits to try to give them information about Al-Qaeda, but in reality, he's still an Al-Qaeda operative.
Yeah. The CIA and the Israelis all accused MI6 of letting all these terrorists live in London. Now, we knew about this guy, Aswad. Back in 1999, he came to America. The Justice Department wanted to indict him in Seattle because him and his buddy were trying to set up a terrorist training school in Oregon. The headquarters of the U.S. Justice Department ordered the Seattle prosecutors not to touch Aswad.
Hello. Now, hold on. Why?
And that's... Well, apparently, Aswad was working for British intelligence. Now, there's a split of opinion within U.S. intelligence. Some people say that the British intelligence fibbed to us. They told us that Aswad was dead, and that's why the New York group dropped the case. That's not what most of the Justice Department said. They believe it was just, again, covering up for this very publicly affiliated guy with Al Mujarrab. He was a British intelligence plant. Our CIA says, okay, let's arrest him, but the Brits say no again? The Brits say no. Now, at this point, 2 weeks ago, the Brits know that the CIA wants to get a hold of Haroon. So what happens? He takes off again. Goes right to London. He isn't arrested when he lands. He isn't arrested when he leaves.
Even though he's on a watch list.
He's on the watch list. The only reason he could get away with that was if he was working for British intelligence. He was a wanted man.
And then takes off the day before the bombing, I understand it.
Yeah. And goes to Pakistan.
To Pakistan
and is arrested.
They jail him.
They jail him. He's released within 24 hours.
In London, we spoke with David Shaler, a former MI5 agent who was convicted of breaking the Official Secrets Act and imprisoned for 6 months.
With regard to 77, there has been witness reports, now included in a local British newspaper, having Cambridge Union News, in which somebody who was on one of the tube trains says that he didn't see a man with a rucksack. In fact, after the explosion, what he saw was metal pointed upwards in the bomb of the carrier. That would indicate, of course, that the bomb was not carried onto the tube train, but was in fact attached underneath it. Now again, nobody in the British national press is following that up. I hope the investigation of the police are.
A current member of British Parliament and a former cabinet minister in Prime Minister Tony Blair's government, Michael Meacher was sacked in 2003 for raising important questions on the eve of the Iraq War.
It's
funny with slower.
7th of July, 7th report. It's a very convenient way of ensuring there is fear, of ensuring that there is control, and of ensuring that those who are in the know, and of course we cannot tell you because it's a secret, are in a position of extreme power.
As part of our inquiry into the London bombing, we wanted to investigate the suspicious death of Jean-Charles de Mendes. Within days of his brutal murder at the Stockwell tube station in the London Underground, evidence of a cover-up began to emerge.
What did you witness with the unfortunate Brazilian man that died?
We all we saw was the police running in to the station with guns. That's all we saw. We didn't see anything else at all. And then after that, a couple of seconds after that, we were vacated down Southampton Road. That was all we saw. We didn't see anything else.
Are you sad for him and his family that he's dead?
Oh, yeah. But at the end of the day, he should have stopped and surrendered, shouldn't he? If it had happened in his own country, he would have been shot down as well. So with all that's gone on, the police weren't doing what they thought was best, as far as I'm concerned.
Why do you think he ran?
Well, because his visa had run out, obviously. He's not going to have armed police running after him just because his visa's run out, has he? So, the police were protecting, you know, the people travelling on the tube, so I don't see any wrong in what the police have done at all.
That's a crazy cultural difference between them and that.
It's a lot of shooting.
How many times did you hear that they shot him?
Five at first. Five, and then no, three first, then five, then he went up to eight. So...
And the police have been tackled in the show.
Well, they told him to surrender, didn't they? They told him to stop, and he didn't. He carried on running, so... Yeah. What else could they have done, as far as I'm concerned?
007, huh?
007.
License to kill.
Yeah. I still believe that there should be a shoot to kill policy. I still believe. Personally. But that's my view, you know. Yeah. I think people should give up their liberty to freedom.
Alright.
London police were later forced to admit that Mr. de Mendes never ran from them, wasn't wearing a heavy coat, and that a special army unit had killed him execution style with over 10 shots to the head at point-blank range. The British government was so desperate to keep the details of the shooting secret, they went so far as to arrest an
IGN television journals who had simply gotten a copy of what would normally be a public police report. Government whistleblowers and police have also been suspended and arrested for telling the truth. We had our details taken and were threatened with arrest simply for asking questions of locals outside the Stockwell station and videotaping police.
Where are you based?
Austin, Texas.
Alex, what's on your day work? I'm 2-11-74. Did you just grab a cigarette?
I'm all set, Jim.
Oh, here, let me do it. Just take it down.
You're filming for program maintenance needs or something.
Exactly. In fact, I think it'll probably be broken in the...
It'll probably be broken in the...
Sir, what do you think about this event?
I think it's very bad, Mrs. Hoffman.
What do you think should happen?
I think the policy of shooting should have been more thoroughly thought out. I'm afraid there must have been a terrible mistake here.
I feel very sorry for the family and very sorry for the policeman that made a horrible mistake.
Yeah, it's going to be bad for everybody.
It's a tragedy all around, I think.
Thank you.
The police first claimed that it was a hot morning, when official weather reports showed that it was around 60 degrees, and that Mr. Jimenez was running down the street wearing a giant padded coat with wires sticking out of it, that he vaulted over the turnstiles, charged through a crowd of pedestrians, raced onto the train, and was about to detonate bombs when the heroic officers gunned him down. The authorities then conveniently claimed that all the surveillance cameras malfunctioned that morning. Police have now been forced to admit, thanks to watchdogs in their ranks, that none of the cameras malfunctioned, and they've now released the video. The government has now been forced to admit that he was wearing a light denim jacket, and there were no wires of any type. Police that weren't part of the special military unit didn't know why they killed him. The police had followed him from his home. They knew that he was a Latin Brazilian working in England as an electrician. They followed him for 30 minutes as he walked from his home towards the station. Once in the station, he calmly bought a Metro paper, paid for his ticket with his Metro Oyster card, and then walked onto the train. Passengers then reported that they were told to get off the train. Once they'd stepped off, still looking through the windows, they saw the Special Forces police squat on Mr. Jimenez and shoot him over 10 times in the head. Witnesses said Jimenez looked at the authorities as if he knew them. He was like a scared rabbit. He was killed execution style. The question is why. A special military hit team stopped him and tracked him from his home to the train station and then killed him in cold blood, making sure he was dead. It's well known that if somebody has a bomb, you don't shoot at them. And you certainly don't get near them. No, Mr. Jimenez had seen something he wasn't supposed to see. He learned a little too much. He had to be eliminated. We were at the station just a week after he was killed, and many of the facts we've covered were already public knowledge. But still, some of the locals made excuses for the police. Within hours of the 7-7 bombings, Israeli Army radio was reporting that Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister of Israel, had been warned not to leave his hotel that morning to attend a meeting less than 100 yards away from one of the train stations that was bombed. The Associated Press ran the headline, Netanyahu changed plans due to warning. Then the current Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon's office, instructed Israeli officials not to give interviews to the foreign media concerning the warning. Israel's foreign office attempted to spin the story, saying that they'd given a general warning to the British that day. Then several weeks later, the head of Mossad told a major German newspaper that he indeed had issued a warning to Benjamin Netanyahu at 8:40 a.m., 10 minutes before the first blast. Conveniently for authorities, the bus surveillance camera malfunctioned. Something else happened that was convenient for the establishment line. All four of the supposed bombers' identification cards survived unscathed at all four events. There was just one problem. In one case, one of the bombers' IDs was found at two separate locations. As the evidence mounts, it is crystal clear. Only criminal elements of the British government could stage the attacks and then engage in the cover-up. The reason that Netanyahu story is important is it clearly shows that other intelligence agencies were aware of what was going on in London that day and took necessary precautions to protect their Minister of Finance.
In 1994, the Israeli embassy in London bombed. This was at a time when I was in service. I joined the Middle Eastern section shortly after that. And I was actually astounded to read a document written by a senior MI5 officer who'd seen all the information coming in about this attack. And he said that he believed that the Israelis had bombed their own embassy.
In any staged terror attack, governments have to be extremely careful to keep the operation shielded, compartmentalized. Most people in government are moral individuals who believe that they're standing up for their nation's sovereignty, for its national interests.
We can listen to it.
It's absolutely essential to keep them in the dark. One of the chief